You're listening to the micro version of the Savage Lovecast, www.savagelovecast.com.
If you're stuck in a relationship quandary, or if you're looking for sexual harmony, well, there's nothing you can't ask on the Savage Lovecast.
My favorite thing that happened last week, well, actually, I think it's my second or third favorite thing, after Marine Le Pen getting her anti-immigrant, anti-EU, anti-gay marriage ass handed to her by a hot guy in a non-traditional marriage, and maybe after a series of photographs that a friend in Europe has been sharing with me over the course of the last week, my third favorite thing that happened last week was something Donald Trump said to the Prime Minister of Australia. Trump is being Trump at the start of this clip, and I'm sorry, I apologize in advance, you're going to have to listen to Donald Trump's voice for just a second. I know that's triggering for some folks. Here's your trigger warning. Trump is being Trump at the start of this clip. At first, every word that comes out of his disgusting mouth is a big lie. But at the end of the clip, Trump accidentally tells the truth.
Could get maybe even better. It's a very good bill right now. The premiums are going to come down very substantially. The deductibles are going to come down. It's going to be fantastic health care. Right now, Obamacare is failing. We have a failing health care. I shouldn't say this to our great gentleman and my friend from Australia, because you have better health care than we do.
Yes. Yes, that is true. Australia has a better health care system than we do. Absolutely, Mr. President, right you are. Australia has universal health care, single-payer, government-run health care. They call it Medicare, and as CNN reported, it gives citizens, quote, free access to doctors and public hospitals. Backing up quickly to the start of the clip and all those lies, Paul Krugman said it best in yesterday's New York Times, quote, Trump care breaks every promise Republicans made about health. Deductibles will rise, not fall. Premiums may fall for a handful of young, healthy, affluent people, but will rise for those who are older, sicker, or poorer. Many people with pre-existing conditions will find insurance either completely unavailable or totally out of their financial reach. Now, jumping back to Australia's healthcare system, it's not really free, of course. Nothing is free. Australian citizens pay for Medicare. All taxpayers pay 2% of their income to support the Medicare system in Australia, and wealthy Australians pay an additional 1% of their income. Healthcare in Australia is free the same way roads and bridges and sidewalks in Australia are free. Everyone gets to use them because everyone pays for them. Which brings us to something Paul Ryan said a few weeks ago, and I apologize. After inflicting Donald Trump's voice on you, I'm also going to inflict a little bit of Paul Ryan on you.
The fatal conceit of Obamacare is that we're just going to make everybody buy our health insurance at the federal government level. Young and healthy people are going to go into the market and pay for the older, sicker people. So the young, healthy person is going to be made to buy health care, and they're going to pay for the person, you know, who gets breast cancer in her 40s. Or who gets heart disease in his 50s. So take a look at this chart. The red slice here are what I would call people with pre-existing conditions, people who have real health care problems. The blue is the rest of the people in the individual market. That's the market where people don't get health insurance at their jobs, where they buy it themselves. The whole idea of Obamacare is the people on the blue side pay for the people on the red side. The people who are healthy pay for the people who are sick. It's not working, and that's why it's in a death spiral.
Yeah, people who are healthy pay to cover people who are sick. That is literally how health insurance works. That's how all insurance works. Homeowners insurance, people whose houses don't burn down, pay to rebuild houses of people whose homes did burn down. Car insurance, people who don't get in accidents or haven't gotten into an accident, pay to cover the medical and legal liabilities of people who have gotten into car accidents. Health insurance is like homeowners insurance and car insurance, except when it comes to health, everyone gets sick and everyone dies. That's what Ryan conveniently leaves out. Everyone is going to get sick eventually. Very few of us are lucky enough to die instantly and without ever having had to see a doctor or stay in a hospital ever in our lives. Even if you are one of the lucky ones, even if a piano falls on your ass and you are squashed to death in an instant, the people you love, your parents, your siblings, your kids, they're going to need health care, most likely. Not everyone you know is going to get squished flat by a fucking piano in a Looney Tunes cartoon and go out that way. It is a big lie. The way Republicans frame the health care debate is just a big lie, and it's told as a means to the GOP end in all things, which is slashing taxes for the wealthy. And health isn't the only place where the GOP pushes this kind of tragical, magical thinking. Other people might need X, but you don't, so why should you have to pay for it? Why should you pay for schools your kids don't attend? Why should you pay for healthcare when you might never get sick and you might never die? Why should you support higher taxes on the wealthy? This is America, after all, and you're not going to want to pay those taxes once you get rich, right? Yeah, but if you think about it for a split second, which apparently no one in the GOP base has ever done, even if you don't have kids, you need other people's kids to get a fucking education, because other people's kids are the nurses, engineers, lawyers, doctors, taxpayers that you're going to rely on in the future. We all need health insurance because, I'm sorry to tell you, we are all going to get sick and we are all going to die. And the wealthy should pay their fair share of taxes, the fair share that you should pay if you get wealthy, which, despite myths about upward mobility and the American dream, you almost certainly won't. They tell these lies because they're con artists. They tell these lies because the GOP exists to do one thing: slash taxes on the wealthiest Americans. Period. Full stop. And to do that, they will stand back and watch you die. They will stand back and watch your poorly educated or uneducated kids die. They will starve all public services to pour more money into the coffers of the wealthiest Americans, to relieve the tax burden on those whose tax burden has gotten lighter and lighter and lighter over the past 40 years. Remember that while you listen to Trump lie and Paul Ryan lie about what they're doing. They're not crafting a better, more humane healthcare system with access for all. When they say access for all, they just mean anybody who has the money can buy it, which is like saying, I have access to Brad Pitt's dick because he's wearing pants with a zipper and anybody can unzip his pants if you have access to that zipper, which I don't. You will not have access to healthcare if you have a pre-existing condition, because you will not be able to afford the rates that they charge. And that is by design. They don't want you to be able to afford those rates, because making healthcare impossible for you to purchase means they can slash taxes on the wealthiest Americans, which is what it's all about. We've got to stop falling for this. Jumping back to Australia, yeah, they have a better healthcare system than we do. They have single payer. They have universal healthcare. That is what we should have. That is what we deserve. And Australia isn't the only country in the world with this kind of healthcare system. Most Western industrialized nations have them, have universal healthcare, including two countries that, according to the GOP, can literally do no wrong. Those two countries are, of course, Israel, which has a universal healthcare system that covers also abortion, and Vatican City, which has a universal healthcare system. They don't cover abortion, Vatican City, in their healthcare system, of course, because altar boys can't get pregnant. All right, coming up on today's show, sex, sex, sex. Lots of your sex questions, lots of my sex answers. Stick around. Today's Savage Lovecast is brought to you by MeUndies. High quality, super comfortable, good looking undies. Get 20% off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/Savage. Today's episode is brought to you by Stamps.com. Stamps.com brings all the services of the U.S. Postal Service right to your fingertips. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, any class of mail using your own computer and printer. And right now you can enjoy the stamp service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in my code SAVAGE. That's Stamps.com, click the mic. Enter Savage. Today's episode is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers all fresh, high-quality ingredients and recipes you need to create delicious home-cooked meals. Get your first 3 meals for free by going to blueapron.com/savage.
Hi, Dan. I'm a 31-year-old woman living in the Midwest, and I have a question about sex drive. So my boyfriend, we've been together for about 4 months, and when we first got together, the sex was really, really good, like definitely the best sex I've ever had. But his sex drive has just kind of stopped completely, just nothing. And while that's fine for now, we're trying to figure out, you know, what do you do about this? I've done some reading, and so we know that maybe we could set a day of the week, that sex day. I know also you talk about, you know, this idea of like just doing it and seeing if that helps. I feel kind of awkward suggesting that as his partner. And then obviously also trying, you know, to get high and see if that helps. So we know those are things we can do. But what else? I'm trying to find other things we can try. Do you have any suggestions?
My first suggestion would be to rewind the tape. I guess podcasts aren't on tape, but to rewind it using your rewind podcast feature and listen to yourself. Listen particularly to this.
Well, that's fine for now.
And let's listen to that again.
Fine for now.
It doesn't sound fine. The tone of your voice does not communicate things are fine for now or at all. You're 4 months into this relationship and the sex was great, best you've ever had at the start. And then at some point in the last 20 short weeks, his libido completely collapsed. And then in the last 20 weeks, you got to the point where you're contemplating the strategies that stressed out new parents employ and people who've been married for 15 or 20 years and kind of lost the thread sexually employ, which is to schedule sex, to set a sex date, to throw yourselves in it or at it or at each other and see if you don't catch a group. Those are strategies that people employ under a kind of sexual duress and ennui. And typically people aren't there in 20 weeks or 4 months. So things are not fine for now. They're not fine. The first step is for you to admit what the tone of your voice is clearly communicating when you say things are fine, which is that things are not fine. And you are not feeling good about this relationship or good about this guy or confident that things can turn around. You never mention what he says about this, about why his libido has cratered. That must be a conversation that you have had with him. And you don't mention any external forces. You don't mention that he's finishing his PhD. You don't mention that both of his parents died in a sudden car crash. You don't mention any new job stresses or anything else that sometimes can really crater someone's libido or him going on antidepressants. Maybe just 20 weeks into the relationship, maybe he went on antidepressants recently and doesn't feel comfortable disclosing that to you at the moment. If I was with somebody for just a few weeks and my doctor prescribed antidepressants to me, that might not be something I would disclose right away to somebody that I was just getting to know. There's something up with him and you don't seem to have any idea what that thing might be. And he indeed owes you an explanation and you can't get anywhere. You can throw yourself at him. You can throw a pot at him. You can throw scheduled sex at him, but absent some explanation from him about what he might think is going on here, we don't know. We're flying blind, trying to fix a problem when we don't know what that problem is. And that is not fine for now or at all. So I would go to him if I were you, if I were in your shoes. My advice to you is to go to him and say, this is a problem. I'm seeking a romantic and sexual partner. If you're not interested in me or the sex isn't there or you don't feel as strongly about me as I feel about you, maybe we should part ways. Or if there's some other issue that is preventing us from being intimate, preventing you from being intimate, you either need to open up to me about what that is so I know how long a drought I'm in for and what the problem is, or we need to part ways for now and then circle back in 6 months or a year when this problem, if there is indeed a problem, has righted itself, or have you managed to solve it, or you're ready to disclose it to me and share the problem with me that then maybe we could work on together. But without any information, yeah, I'm not willing to stick with this indefinitely because it ain't fine. It ain't fine.
Hi, Dan. This is a 26-year-old Canadian girl. I have a really bit of a messed up situation. I started dating someone in 2015, and then he broke up with me because I wasn't nice, and then he came back like 5 hours later because that was dumb. And then he broke up with me a couple months after that because he thought he was gay. 8 months later, after not talking to me, he came back and we started being friends. And then he decided he wasn't gay and we got back together. I know, I'm crazy, right? Well, everything's been great. We've been working through whatever issues come up. So last week, I took some things and got some levels of high and some of my insecurities about the relationship came out. And one of the big ones was his ex-girlfriend, and we worked through it and we talked about it, and I felt much better by the end of the day, the next day. But now he doesn't know why he's with me. And I don't know what to do. I feel like my bringing out my insecurities at the time was kind of different because I had been on some drugs. And so I wasn't like all there, but he's sober, fully aware, and telling me that he doesn't know if he wants to be with me. Side note, we were both Mormon. We don't go to church anymore. So there's a lot of like weird religious stuff. It sounds really messy when I say it out loud, but I love this man. I don't know if it's fair for him to not know if he wants to be with me after everything that he's put me through. I've been there for him the whole time. I've tried to be his friend even when he didn't want me to be, and just gave him space when he needed space. It's been on and off for over a year now, and maybe it's not worth it. Can you let me know if I'm being fair or not?
You are being really unfair to yourself. You have to dump the motherfucker already. How many different ways does he have to communicate to you that what he's putting you through, this emotional roller coaster, this emotional grinder, is not ancillary to the relationship? It's not a side note. It is the note. It is what this relationship for him is about. It's about pushing you away. It's about punching you in the face symbolically, psychically, not literally, and then seeing if you're going to walk back, see if you're going to take him back. This is about his ego. This is about his, in my opinion, narcissism. It has nothing to do with being escapees from the Mormon religion or cult or whatever you want to call it. This is just common, everyday relationship assholery where you were involved with some sort of psychologically sadistic narcissist who likes to punch you in the face and see if you will stay to be punched in the face again. And the only question for you is whether that's fair, not to him, to you, fair to yourself. Are you being fair to yourself by sticking the fuck around? It's only been a year. You don't really know someone well enough to say you love them with the intensity you seem to love this guy after a year together when you haven't been together that entire year. He's been there and gone and there and gone and gay and back. How much time have you actually spent with him? Stop pursuing this asshole. He is not the only man on the planet. There are 4 billion other dudes out there. Go throw yourself and your affection and your concern and your compassion and your commitment to making love work at someone who is capable of loving you back. And this asshole is not capable of loving you back. This asshole is just an asshole. And you have to stop sitting there thinking, oh, if I can just figure him out, if I can unpack the mystery of his damage, then I'll be able to pick all the locks on his heart and we will love. No, you will not be able to pick all the locks on his heart and he will be able to love you once you heal him. Because as we've said on the show a million times, your tits aren't magic. Your pussy ain't magic. You can't save him. He is who he is. He is who he has revealed himself to you to be, which is an asshole who does not care about you. An asshole who only cares about himself. Yes, part of what being in love is about, part of what a relationship, a committed relationship is about, is toughing through the hard times when they come. It's also about loving someone despite their flaws and their faults. Someone who is attempting to love you despite your flaws and your faults. But you can't love someone who either doesn't love you. I mean, you can, but it's kind of pathetic, and eventually you have to walk away. And you can't love someone who is incapable of loving you and is not there to love you, but is there to beat the shit out of you, figuratively. This is an emotionally abusive relationship. You need to get the fuck out of it. Dump this messy, chaotic, damaged person and go find a messy, chaotic, damaged person, because all of us are kind of messy, kind of chaotic, kind of damaged. But you got to find one who's functional, who despite their damage, despite their messiness, despite the chaos of human life and existence, is capable of loving you on top of all of that. And this guy is not. So go. You are not a bad person if you leave someone who is incapable of loving you and only seems to be capable of abusing you and playing you and convincing you that the abuse isn't abuse, but some terrible tragedy that they themselves are suffering. And if you walk out on them now, you're the monster. No. Leave the piece of shit. Dump the motherfucker already. Can we talk about your underpants? Because your underwear drawer could probably use a little freshening up, don't you think? But look, here comes MeUndies to help. What is MeUndies? It's seriously soft, feel-good undies delivered right to your door and right to your drawers. MeUndies are designed in the USA and made from sustainably sourced micromodal, a fabric 3 times softer than cotton. MeUndies Softer Than Soft Luxe Undies come in an ever-changing selection of classic colors, bold shapes, and adventurous patterns, so you can tailor your undies to your personal style. And you can save time and money each month with a monthly subscription. And if you're not ready for a subscription, that's okay too. You can still save. That's because MeUndies is offering you 20% off your first pair. Just use our special URL, MeUndies.com/savage, to get 20% off your first pair of MeUndies. So go ahead, revamp your underwear drawer. Once again, that's MeUndies.com/savage, MeUndies.com/savage.
Hey, Dan, 33-year-old straight guy from San Francisco. I just went through a really traumatic disease over the course of the last year and a half or so, and I'm trying to start dating again, but I'm not as interested in sex or in women as I used to be. Part of that is on dates, I haven't had that new relationship excited energy because I'm just so happy to be alive. After going through this disease, that I'm already at maximum happiness. It's hard to be more happy than maximum happy. And then another part of it is that when I was sick, I never knew what would happen on any particular day. I didn't know if I'd end up in a hospital or if I was in the hospital when I'd get to leave. And so part of coping with the disease, I just became very accepting of whatever happened. And I think this attitude is transferred over to dating in that instead of really seeking out, you know, women and trying to, you know, do my best and put on my best, you know, face and dress nicely, I more have the attitude that, you know, I'm here doing my thing, and if they want to find me, they can come find me. And then to top this all off, right as I was about to hit my bottom health-wise, my fiance and I broke up. So it's also been a while since I've been dating.
So you say you're ready to get out there and start dating, but you're not so interested right now in a relationship or sex or women particularly. So it's not dating that you're interested in. It's getting out and living. It's perhaps companionship and company that you want, some human contact, some intimacy of the non-sexual and non-intensely romantic variety. Lead with that. Put that out there on your personal ads, or if you contact people through online personals, don't hide that. Don't cover that up, because you know what? There are probably lots of other people out there, men and women, and if it's not about sex, it's not about romance, it's not about relationships, you can seek companionship with anyone, who've just come out of the other side of some challenging shit, a health crisis, as you are now on the other side of, and congratulations, and I'm glad you're well, a divorce, a major family tragedy, the election of Donald J. Trump, who might just want to get out of the house and hang out and make contact. And that's where you are right now. So lead with that. Because there are, I promise you, and I hear from them at Savage Love, the column, and at the podcast, there are people out there who want to go on low-stakes social dates, who want interactions, who want a reason to leave the house and someone to hang out with and be with, who has really low expectations of them romantically or sexually. So this thing that you think disqualifies you from dating is actually a quality that will attract some people to you who would like to date just that kind of guy. So my advice is to put that out there, lead with that, find other people in your shoes who want what you want right now in the limited way that you want it right now, and date them. And again, congratulations on coming through on the other side of your health crisis. We're all glad you're well. Stamps saves you time and money, which you can use to grow your business. Mail any letter, any package using just your computer and printer, and the mail carrier picks it up. Avoid the hassle of the post office and mail everything from postcards to envelopes to packages, domestic or international, from your own home. Create your Stamps account in minutes online with no equipment to lease and no long-term commitments. Click, print, mail, you are done. And like the post office, Stamps.com never closes. Print postage for letters or packages at your convenience 24/7, 7 days a week. Stamps.com makes it easy. They'll send you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage. No need to lease an expensive postage meter. And right now, you can enjoy the stamp service with a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus postage and a digital scale without long-term commitments. Go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in my code, SAVAGE. That's stamps.com, enter SAVAGE. Stamps.com, never, ever go to the post office again.
Hi, Dan. I'm wondering if it is ever okay to out someone The person that I'm wondering about is my daughter. She's 13, and she recently came out to me as gay. And this is totally fine. I love her, accept her. She knows this. But what I'm worried about is my mom. We don't live in the same state as her, and she usually comes for a visit over the summer. And she is also one of those people who believes that being gay is wrong, but, you know, you have to love the sinner and hate the sin, which is an idea that I find really offensive. And my daughter knows this about her grandmother and has expressed some anxiety about this visit and is a little apprehensive. She definitely doesn't want to hide anything. And she doesn't have a girlfriend. I mean, she's only 13. She's just a kid. But this is something that's really prominent in her mind and something that she's coming to terms with. And she is very open about, and it's not something that she would want to hide. And I think she's worried that if the subject of, you know, hey, do you have any boys at school that you like? If my mom asks that question, that she's, you know, she's going to be honest when she answers. So I'm wondering, is it okay to talk to my mom first and tell her that her granddaughter is gay and warn her, like, set some limits, like, look, like, you're entitled to believe whatever you want to believe, and I find it offensive, but if that's what you want to believe, fine. But if you want to have a relationship with your granddaughter and you don't want to hurt her feelings, then you need to accept her and keep those opinions to yourself. I kind of feel like if I do this, on the one hand, it's really not my place to talk about my daughter's sexual orientation with other people. Like, that should be her news to share. But also, I don't want her to be caused pain. And I also, like, don't want my mom to be taken by surprise either. And I think she would be. And I think she might have an inappropriate reaction that would maybe further injure my daughter. So I'm wondering, is it okay to have that discussion with my mom? And I don't know that my daughter would want me to do that. So it would probably be something that I would do without her permission. I don't know. What do you think?
It is okay to have that conversation, that discussion with your mother in the abstract. You should not out your 13-year-old daughter to her grandmother. At 13, at your daughter's age, it has to be up to her who she wants to be out with. And you're going to have to, as my mother put it, step into the closet a little bit with your daughter. You're going to have to be the semi-partly closeted mother of a gay teenager, because you don't want to rush her out or hustle her out or force her or compel her or out her to members of the family that she is not ready to come out to yet. That said, your mother, if you have siblings, if there are other grandchildren, granddaughters, grandsons, you can have a conversation with your mother right now about what she believes about LGBT kids and LGBT adults. And you can tell her, you know, statistically, mom, odds are good that you have a gay grandchild. And you don't have to say, and she's my daughter. You can just keep it in the abstract. And if she says, what are you telling your daughter? Say, no, mom, but odds are you have a gay grandchild, a queer one, maybe a trans one, maybe a bi one, but odds are good, because a lot of people are queer, that one of your grandkids is queer. And you saying these hurtful things about queer people is going to, in the long run, destroy your relationship with your grandchild who is queer, if indeed you have a queer one. And it's bad for other kids who might be queer to overhear, and it's shitty, and you shouldn't be saying it. And you should have said this shit to your mother years ago. You should have said this shit to your mother when your daughter was 2. Not wait till your daughter is 13 to confront your mother. 13 and out to you to confront your mother about the shitty things that she believes in. Sounds like routinely says about queer people. And you don't have to end with, if that's what you want to believe, that's fine. Because you know what? It is not fine. And you have to stand up to her. It is not fine. And fuck you, mom. It is not fine. And we're not going to agree to disagree about this. You're going to come the fuck around. This is how families work on this issue. Strong people in families stand up to shitty, hateful people in families and communicate to them that there is a new norm in this family around love and acceptance, and they have got to get with the program. When I came out to my mother, sometimes I worry you all get sick of these stories about when I came out to my mother, but when I came out to my mother and was ready to come out to the whole family, My mother let everybody know that if anybody had a problem with me, they had a much bigger problem with her. And that was the depth charge. That was a bomb she dropped because everybody wanted to be in good with my mother. Because my mom was Christmas house and my mom was the matriarch and my mom was the oldest daughter. And my mom was the beloved aunt. And ultimately the grandmother. But at that time, not a grandmother, matriarch, eldest daughter, aunt. And she threw down. And that brought a lot of my relatives around who weren't necessarily comfortable with me, but they didn't want to be uncomfortable with my mother. And that's what you have to do with yours. You have to make sure that your daughter isn't uncomfortable with you or around anyone else in the family, but that anyone who's going to make your daughter feel uncomfortable is going to be very uncomfortable with the grief that you're going to give them. So, mom, get out in front of it. The conversation with your mother now, in the abstract, don't out your daughter. And when the time comes that your daughter is ready to come out to the extended family, be a mama lion. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country, and it's what I had for dinner last night. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone, even me. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. For less than $10 per person per meal, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-proportioned ingredients so you can make delicious home-cooked meals at home. Choose from a variety of new recipes each week or let Blue Apron's culinary team surprise you. Recipes are not repeated within a year, so you will never get bored. Customize your recipes each week based on your preferences, and Blue Apron has several delivery options so you can choose what fits your needs. And there's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want them. Here are a couple of items on the menu that are coming up. Stir-fried chicken and udon noodles with asparagus and carrots, and baked spinach with egg flatbreads. Check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals for free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/savage. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. And if I can cook them, you can cook them, and I have been cooking them. That's blueapron.com/savage. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Hi, Dan. I'm a mid-40s straight cis woman in a 20-year monogamous marriage calling from New York. And I have a question about my gynecologist. For us, monogamish means that my husband gets a pass to see a sex worker when he's out of town. So about 6 weeks ago, he was out of town taking care of getting his mom into a nursing home, and he called a sex worker to kind of blow off some steam from all the frustration of that. He was going down on her, and she unexpectedly got her period, so there was a little bit of concern about STIs, not big concern, but we wanted to get testing. So last week I had an appointment with a new gynecologist, and she's at a satellite clinic of one of the major medical centers here in New York. And the physical exam she did was fine, but after establishing that I was married, she didn't ask any questions about sex or our relationship. And at the end of the appointment, when she ordered blood work, I asked if she was including STI screening. And what bothered me is she responded, well, no, you're married. I pursued it, and she did order the screening at my request, so I'm fine, I'm safe, it's all good. But later, I was really bothered by the public health aspect of her assumptions. I'm pretty good at advocating for and getting what I need, but I know that's not true for everybody. And I'm bothered by her assumption that marriage equals monogamy and that all her married patients and all of their partners do monogamy perfectly, since, as you often point out, most people don't. I didn't say anything to her other than asking for the test and making sure I got it. But now I'm feeling like I should have spoken up. Is there something I could have said or done to make it easier for the next married woman who wants testing and, you know, who is in a non-monogamous relationship or whose partner might have cheated or whatever? Because I'd like to help be that change.
So we caught you walking down the street in a big city. So if other people are listening, wondering what the noise is about, that's it. But I had a follow-up question for you. Why didn't you tell your doctor you're in a non-monogamous relationship? Why didn't you just tell your doctor. It would make her more sensitive to the existence of couples in non-monogamous relationships if she knew you were one of them and one of her patients was one of them.
You know, I'm not sure. I guess I just kind of choked on that. I mean, it's not something that we are socially monogamous. So it's not a thing I'm accustomed to talking about if people don't ask. And I guess it was just her reaction. She was like, "What, you're married?" You know, like, this was the answer to everything.
And that is a crazy reaction on her part. There's a study from the Journal of Sexual Medicine from a few years ago called A Comparison of Sexual Health History and Practices Among Monogamous and Consensually Non-Monogamous Sexual Partners. And it found that people in monogamous relationships were at as high a risk for sexually transmitted infection as people in non-monogamous relationships were, in honest, ethical non-monogamous relationships. Were. So monogamy doesn't protect people from sexually transmitted infections. Women who have husbands who are supposed to be monogamous are as likely to get a sexually transmitted infection as women who are in non-monogamous relationships. And your doctor needs to know that. And you could print that study out and give it to her.
Uh-huh.
But the most powerful thing you could do is come out to her. She's your healthcare provider. This is something,
right.
You know, this... you know, arrangement, this choice you and your husband have made, your relationship model, it doesn't put you at higher risk than monogamous couples, but it is a health concern. And you should not be
right.
shy about sharing that with your doctor. And hopefully that will help her not be such a fucking idiot about this kind of crap.
Okay. So the next time I see her, I'll try and like address that more clearly. I guess I was so surprised by her reaction, you know? Because I expect somebody who works in women's health to
not
be
an
aware
idiot.
That. Yeah.
We all expect people, particularly people who can get their asses through med school, not to be idiots. But the sex negativity in our culture and in our med schools is so pervasive that even our doctors don't want to see us necessarily as sexual actors. And it's more comfortable for some to tiptoe around or ignore sexual risk than to address it head on.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people out there like you and your husband who are socially monogamous, but not sexually monogamous. And I support that choice. I think that's valid when it comes to neighbors and friends and coworkers and siblings and parents and children, but not when it comes to healthcare providers. That's a fact about your health and your risk that your healthcare provider, that your doctor needs to be aware of.
Okay, yeah, and for us, it is true at, like, the 99% level. I mean, this is, like, maybe once a year, if that, you mm-hmm. know. So it's just something I don't really care, right? If she's away, needs to blow off steam, whatever. So it's, like, it wouldn't even really be accurate for us to say we have an open relationship in the usual sense, you know?
You are who I coined the term monogamish for. You guys
right,
are
that's exactly right.
Mostly monogamous marriage. There's a little squish there around the end, monogamish. Your husband also
exactly.
has the ability to use latex and not just for fucking, not just a condom on his dick, but dental dams that are a thing. And
right.
could have avoided this issue of the sudden onset period problem with the sex worker if he'd been using a dental dam. And I say that knowing that there's not a human being on the planet who's ever used a dental dam, not once.
Sorry, here comes the train.
Okay, well, we'll let you go. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone.
I appreciate your input.
You're welcome. And if you don't want to come out to your doctor as non-monogamous, you can print this study out and bring it to your doctor. But what that then uh-huh. says is that you think your husband is cheating on you without your consent.
I mean, he's a good guy, right? We've been married almost 20 years, and I don't want to really throw him under the bus for no good reason. Even with somebody he doesn't have to interact with.
Yeah, I don't think you should throw him under the bus. I think you should come out to your doctor. I think that would be much more impactful. And hopefully then, when she sees someone in the office, that she will have that in her head as a possibility. That socially monogamous, sexually non-monogamous to whatever limited or expansive extent
uh-huh.
is a thing that couples do, even couples who appear to be monogamous in every other respect.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Sure thing. Good luck.
Hey, Dan. I'm Stephanie calling from Australia, and I had a question mostly about seeing if other people have had a similar experience as me, basically of feeling coerced into sex by being given an orgasm. I recently had an experience where I made it really clear to someone that I was not interested in moving any further, And after a few times of saying no, I relented and allowed him to give me a really great orgasm. And then after the fact, I've now realized that I felt obligated to do the same for him. And I did. I didn't want to in the first place, but I felt like it would have been wrong if I'd gotten away with an orgasm and he didn't. So anyway, just wondering if anybody else has had similar experiences, if this is a thing or maybe even a tactic.
There are anti-rape and anti-rape culture activists out there whose work and mission I completely support, who argue that if you have to beg and plead, if you ask and ask, and the initial answer is no, and you eventually get a yes by persisting, by continuing to ask, that that is not valid. That is not consent. That is rape. That is coercive. And I disagree to some extent with that analysis, because there's a difference between pathetic begging and pleading that results in someone pity fucking you, and coercive threatening begging and pleading that results in someone consenting to sex they don't want to have because they fear you. Pity fuck, fear fuck, two different things. You don't say in your call, I'm sorry, we weren't able to call you back, whether this was a pity fuck consent or a fear fuck consent. Sounds though like it was a pity fuck consent. And therefore, in my estimation, although, you know, he persisted and he asked again and again, and he should have taken no for an answer in the first place, it wasn't rape. You weren't raped. You had sex with this dude. You allowed him to get you off. And then the question becomes, are you obligated after someone gets you off to get them off? And the answer to that is, yeah, kinda. If somebody gets you off, you should return the favor. You don't have to return the favor. You can say, I'd rather not, but that's kind of a dick move. As was the persistent begging and pleading pity fuck request on his part that eventually got you to consent. Also a dick move. So you could have dick moved right back at him. He employed a dick move strategy that got you to consent to allow him to get you off. And you could have retaliated with a dick move strategy where you said, that's it. You can masturbate about that later. You can masturbate about the orgasm you just watched me have later, but I ain't getting you off. Dick move to dick move. But when it comes to sort of the commodification of sexual pleasure and you scratch my back, I scratch your back, you jack my dick, I play with your clit. It says right there in Emily Post and written in Lemon Juice on the back pages, you have to hold it over a candle to see it. If somebody gets you off, the social compact, sexual compact says you should return the favor. You should get them off too. But you don't have to. And it sounds like you didn't want to. But you allowed him to get you off, and then he had a reasonable expectation that you would get him off in return. It was unreasonable of him to beg and plead and get you to pity fuck him. So you could have said no, but that's not the question you asked. You asked, am I obligated when somebody gets me off to return the favor and get them off? Yeah, kind of, but there are outs. And next time you know, to employ that out. And there's a lot of gray here and a lot of subjectivity at play here, because some dude may think that he's begging and pleading in a pity fuck way and he's in no way being coercive or threatening. But that may not be how the woman that he is begging and pleading for the pity fuck is experiencing it. Maybe she's been sexually assaulted in the past. Maybe he doesn't understand how he comes across. Maybe he's much more physically imposing than she is. And men are volatile, testosterone-soaked dick monsters. She may worry that he's about to go nuclear. It's going to go from pathetic pity fuck request to coercive, threatening non-request. And then consent is going to be nuked or not on the table anymore. So this exists on a continuum. There's a lot of gray and a lot of nuance. That said, there is a distinction I think that can be made between you fucked somebody out of pity and you fucked somebody out of fear.
Hey, Dan, just listening to the woman who's going to be a maid of honor in her bipolar friend's wedding and can't do it anymore. And I would say, don't do anything with her anymore. Cut her off. It's okay. I'm the bipolar one, and my dear friend that I was leaning on cut me off a few years ago, and it was really, really painful, but probably necessary, and we took 2 years off and then reconnected, and we're now best friends again, but I no longer think that I need to use her as my therapist. I take better care of myself and my own bipolar now, so respect your impulse and cut her off and don't feel guilty. If you're meant to be friends, you can renegotiate that in a couple years.
Hey, I wanted to respond to the caller about being gay in Jerusalem. I'm an American. I was raised in America, but I was raised ultra-Orthodox Jewish. And as an adult, after I've stopped being religious, I've visited Jerusalem. And it's a really interesting city, and it's kind of my experience relates what the caller said. But you have to realize that Jerusalem is a religious city. You've got religious Jews, religious Muslims, religious Christians. Everybody is there for religion. So there's not really going to be like a gay scene. But that said, everywhere there's going to be gay people. And so you end up just having a lot of people having sex in parks. And I had a really great experience having sex in parks there. I had an awesome threesome with two guys. It was so much fun. And I don't think Jews are going to kill you if you have sex with them, especially not in Jerusalem. There are some places I wouldn't push my luck, like maybe New Square in America. But in Jerusalem, you have so many conflicting different mini cults that everybody's a bit more open-minded and accepting. I mean, they're not pro-gay or anything, but I wouldn't be too worried. I think you should go out there and have fun. And if somebody starts following you, just walk to a dark corner somewhere and go have sex in the bushes. It'll be great. And if you're specifically looking for bushes to have sex in, I recommend Gan HaAtzmaut, right around there. On the western side at night, there's like always 20 people wandering around. It's like a mini sort of gay community hangout. People just talk, and sometimes they fuck, and sometimes they just chill out and hang out. So I would say go for it, enjoy it, but I don't think you're going to find a boyfriend or a lover or anything there.
Hey, Dan, straight guy calling to leave a comment about your rant about stealthing. You gave the advice of an awesome move, reaching down to feeling if the condom was broken. I wanted to give the advice that everybody should do that, not only because it is the responsible thing to do, but also because it can be really hot. I had a female partner at one point that was very concerned about condoms breaking, and she totally pulled that move. I didn't realize what she was doing at the time until you described it on your show, and I put the two pieces together of what she had told me prior, and she would incorporate clit stimulation and fondling. Very fun, very hot. I think anyone straight, gay, in between can totally incorporate that and make it a very hot experience.
And we're going to leave it there. 206-302-2064 is the number here at the Savage Lovecast. If you want to record a question or a comment for a future show, give us a buzz. 206-302-2064. I will be appearing at the Palace of Fine Arts Theater in San Francisco on September 15th, 2017 for a live installment of Savage Love. Tickets are available on Ticketmaster.com and on the Palace's website at www.palaceoffinearts.org. If you like my political rants at the top of the show, you will love Blabbermouth, the Stranger's weekly political podcast with me, Rich Smith, and our host, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Eli Sanders. Get Blabbermouth wherever you get your podcasts. Follow me on Twitter at FakeDanSavage. The Savage Lovecast is produced every week by Nancy Hartunian and me and the tech-savvy at-risk youth and Nancy. We'll all be back at you next week for an installment of the Savage Lovecast. Thanks for